This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health. And flu season may be over, but there's more evidence about the advantage of getting a high-dose flu shot if you qualify. So there is a new study which analyzed health data from 165,000 older adults, and it found that the high-dose flu vaccine reduced the risk of Alzheimer's by 55% over about 2 years. Now, the same research team looked at the regular flu shot, and even that one reduced the risk by 40%. So that, to me, is a very interesting finding. And I have to say that when I talk to people, the flu shot is usually the one they say, I can't be bothered. Anyway, here is another survey on another topic that we talk about a lot, and that is misinformation, false health information online. This time it's a survey that was done for the Canadian Medical Association, and 97% of doctors say that they have had to intervene to prevent harm or to try to fix it after patients listen to false claims. And also another topic we've been following. So last week we talked about some changes to the requirements for a medical residency that the Ontario government was making because of a legal challenge. Well, now they're tweaking the rules again, presumably to make it easier for people who have ties to Ontario but went to medical school elsewhere to get one of those coveted spots. So, what do you want to ask? What do you want to know about? Our text line is 866-740-4740. That's also the long distance phone line, local phone line, 416-360-0740.
Now, time for the medical record.
And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Malcolm Moore, who is a medical oncologist at the Princess Margaret, former head of BC Cancer. Dr. Fahad Razak, general internist at St. Michael's Hospital and Canada Research Chair in Healthcare Data and Analytics at the University of Toronto. And Dr. Elisa Naiman, a family doctor practicing in Toronto. Hi, everyone. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Libby.
Hey, Libby.
Okay, well, let's start with this survey about health misinformation. And I want to start with Malcolm because I think there's a lot of it related to cancer, and I don't think it's a new thing.
No, it's not. And anyone who's in practice, and all three of us could tell you, you're talking to someone about an issue, you get to a place where you might say, here's what I would recommend, and then a piece of paper comes out of a bag and I want to ask you some questions. And we then have to go through kind of debunking all this variety of stuff that they've heard about, read about, found on the internet. And it is honestly frustrating because it can take up a lot of time. And you know, most of the stuff is pretty bogus, particularly when you're dealing with a serious illness like I do in the cancer field. So, it is just part of the practice. And you're right, it's something that always happened. People used to come, believe it or not, with newspaper articles. Now it's just internet stuff. Is it more frequent than it was 10 years ago? I think definitely it is.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, there was something about asparagus curing cancer and just a bunch of equally ridiculous things. And then there are also well-meaning people, friends of patients, and they push things on people.
Yeah, the other thing I would say is that there's just always been a need for this idea that there are these natural, healthy remedies for serious illnesses like cancer. And some years ago, there was an attempt to say, well, let's actually properly evaluate some of these things, some of these cocktails. And that was really unproductive because the studies were done on mistletoe or ESIAC, what have you. They showed, as expected, no benefit, but then another one would pop up. So it's just, there is a market for these sort of natural, less unpleasant remedies for cancer, but unfortunately, most of this stuff is not helpful.
Yeah, and then there's also things that might be okay in a normal context, but aren't okay if you're going through treatment, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we tell people is about diet is one of the issues for people on cancer treatment is malnutrition. And the last thing we want people to do, and it's hard for them to get enough calories in because of the side effects of treatment. So we want them to maintain a good caloric intake. We don't really want to them going on some radical diet, eating just carrots and broccoli, because A, they'll lose weight and it's just not the right thing. So we do try to steer people towards sort of more a healthy lifestyle attributes when they're on cancer treatment.
Fahad, what's your experience with health misinformation?
Yeah, as Malcolm said, it's impossible to be a practicing physician now in this country without having to deal with this routinely. Sometimes it's relatively harmless. It's, can I additionally take this thing beyond it? I think it may work. You know, you're giving them treatment for heart failure. Can I additionally take this thing with my breakfast? And we say, we do a quick check on what we know. And we say, sure. The most worrying times at an individual patient basis is where they consider it to be a substitute. So we have an effective therapy. I don't want to take that therapy. I want to use this other thing, which I heard about as being effective. And then we have, you know, at that point, effective therapy is delayed or doesn't happen at all. We see the adverse events. We often deal with the regret, which is tragic. You know, 2-3 months later, I really wish I hadn't done that. So that is very difficult. At a system level, this is like a grenade. Misinformation is like a grenade. It is so difficult to contain the damage around it. And you're playing catch up. The damage happens, and then you're trying to put things back together again. And that is a very difficult process. And if you think about social media, it has been weaponized to draw human attention. So as you're using Facebook or Twitter or these other platforms, the algorithms behind the scenes are seeing how long you take to click something, how long you take to move beyond one image to another. And they're learning from that. They're learning how to trick people and draw attention. And that, to compete against that at an individual physician level, is nearly impossible. And this is the problem. I think we need sort of to learn from how they have weaponized algorithms in social media and think about a response which uses the same kind of technology, which does not rely on an individual clinician as the only way of combating it. You have to have a more system algorithmic way of combating this kind of misinformation.
Oh, that's an interesting thought. You know, Alisa, this conversation is reminding me, I had a very dear friend that I lost, and she had what appeared to be a very treatable kind of cancer, and she refused to take regular treatment, saying, I don't want to put all these chemicals in my body. And at the end, like, you know, a month before she died, she kind of changed her mind, and then she wanted everything at once. But I'm imagining that you come up against this misinformation, I mean, almost every day.
That's right. It's just part of the practice of practicing medicine these days. People will come in, you know, it started for me with people going in looking things up, and they would come in and go, Dr. Google told me this. I'm sure you don't want to hear what I'm going to say, but then they tell me anyways. And then now it's not even Dr. Google. Now it's, I went on ChatGPT and this is what ChatGPT says. And they're very confident with the information that's provided by ChatGPT. And then it becomes, it makes our job harder, if I could be honest, because people have come in and they have this fixed belief. They believe, for some reason, people find it more believable to go with what ChatGPT says. I've talked about TikTok, I've talked about Instagram, than for us to have a conversation and for us to go through evidence and to try to provide evidence-based medicine and help people. It's really fascinating. I told you how a couple of months ago, I said how I had an interaction with a patient who refused to have a pap smear because of the chemical that was on the brush that's used to take the pap. I just couldn't believe this because I have no idea how this could be circulating on social media because it's just so false. And what are the implications of this person not having this test done? They're now putting themselves at risk for developing cervical cancer, which would have been picked up at a much earlier stage. So it's made our job harder. You know, everybody can now go and get their lab results online. And it's very common. There will be some abnormality, which will not be of any clinical significance. And people will have put this information into ChatGPT. They'll put their diagnostic imaging into ChatGPT and basically come in with what they want to do as the next step. And it's costly. And it takes time to try to work with somebody to come up with what would be the best plan for their health.
Speaking of bad things that people put in their bodies, and I'm sorry I didn't flag that I wanted to talk about it, but it's something that's been in the news a lot lately, and it's peptides, and especially young men taking these peptides to build up their muscles, and they can be really dangerous. Alisa, have you encountered that?
So peptides have been throughout the media for the last couple of weeks because there's been concerns about the access, the purity, and why people are taking it. So it's not just young men taking it. Lots of people who are interested in longevity and improving their health will take it. And so probably the most common peptide would be like semaglutide or Ozempic, which is a peptide. Mm-hmm. So there's other peptides, and it's very popular now, probably because in the States, there's been a push by our favorite health person, RFK Jr., to try to push and get it legalized. And once again, there's a lot of information that's available online about the benefits of peptides without people understanding what the risks of it are in terms of, and it's very easy to access. You can go online to an online seller and you can buy a peptide for whatever you want it to be. If you, there's some other GLPs that are in drug trials that you can get as a peptide that you can buy yourself. You can buy peptides that will help you for your skin. You can buy peptides that will help you for your mitochondrial function. You can buy peptides that will help for healing. And the evidence is just not there because there's no trials of them. So that's one issue. And then the issue is what are you actually buying? And what is the purity? What are you actually getting? And that, so this is why Health Canada has brought up this issue in the last couple of weeks, because there's been people suffering consequences of ordering peptides online. And the problem is this is a very gray area. And so people who are very active in getting their information about their health and their well-being from social media are very aware of peptides. They're not going to come and talk to me about it because they know the answer that they would get, but it's very accessible to get.
And what are the risks of peptides, Fahad?
I don't think we know because so much of this is unregulated. There's an entire cottage industry of these peptides being produced. I was quite struck last week. I was in Vancouver, and I feel like Vancouver is maybe a little bit of a warning sign for what is going to happen across the country, because this wellness culture has concentrated a lot on the West Coast, but it doesn't stay there. It spreads everywhere. And I was stunned to see the number of clinics and posters all throughout the downtown that are offering peptide therapy. And they're branded very creatively. So for example, one of the peptides is called the Wolverine Stack, and it's playing on an X-Men comic about a superhero named Wolverine who can always heal after injury. And so who are they targeting? They're targeting young men who are looking for this rapid healing from injury. So they're very smart about the way that they're packaging this. And again, I think from a regulator, oversight, you know, Ministry of Health, Health Canada point of view, I think one step behind would be a kind description of what has happened in this industry. And the problem is, of course, some part, like peptide is a term that covers thousands to tens of thousands of different chemicals, right? And some of them are remarkably important, GLPs. And then there's this entire body of them, which we have no idea, and people are still injecting them. And so it's really a scary underbelly. The wellness movement, there's a lot that I admire about people taking agency and control over their own health. 100% that has to be done. But there is a commercial monetization and misinformation element of it, a very dark underbelly, which is frankly scary.
Yeah, I mean, for years, I've noticed that there's peptides like in my moisturizers. Never gave it a second thought. Maybe I should. But Malcolm, is this a situation where maybe our regulatory authorities have kind of lost the plot? You're muted, Malcolm.
Yeah. So I think Fahad hit the nail on the head. The big issue here is regulation, because, you know, drugs are defined as any compound which alters physiological function. And if we take a drug, that whole industry is highly regulated. If you take a drug, you know what's in it and you know what it does, and it's approved by Health Canada. Outside of this, you have this whole industry of what are actually drugs that are trying to alter physiological function. But A, you don't exactly know what's in some of these things. You're not sure what the quality control and manufacture is. And I think that's part of the danger here, is that you don't know what you're getting. And if these things really do affect things like muscle growth and hormone levels, they need to be treated as drugs and properly regulated.
So how do you, I mean, also given limited resources, how do we tackle this?
Well, the simple answer is you make it illegal to sell drugs that are not that don't go through some regulatory body. Now, that's easier said than done, because some of these things, like Fahad said, are almost manufactured like these magic cocktails or spinach for Popeye, you know, that you just take it. So it's tough. But I mean, if there are real health effects of these compounds, then obviously there's a risk of adverse effects. And we need to think about a way to prevent people, you know, from being harmed by these.
Let's go to some good news. And there's good news, I think, in this study about the preventive effect of a high-dose flu shot, Fahad.
Yeah, look, yet another study showing us that for the vast majority of individuals, vaccines end up providing so much benefit. And these, what I really like about this study is, you think about the flu vaccine, and you're right, Libby, a lot of people are quite dismissive of it. On the hospital side, I have to tell you, it's one of the great tragedies every year for me as we enter the winter season, is caring for people critically ill, some of whom end up dying tragically, who are not vaccinated against this thing, which we know the vaccine's incredibly effective at preventing severe disease for flu. But then there are these other benefits. And so this is building on, we talked a couple months ago about the shingles vaccine and Alzheimer's. The reason why that is a very plausible benefit that the shingles vaccine could reduce Alzheimer's is that we know when these infections occur, there's an enormous amount of inflammation that happens as a response to severe infection. And the fact that that would then trigger adverse events in the brain and other places which are susceptible to that inflammation makes a lot of sense. And here now we see this effect with the flu vaccine. This is not a randomized trial, but it's a very carefully designed study where they're matching people who get the conventional vaccine to people who are getting what's called the high dose flu vaccine, which is especially important for older adults. And they're seeing a protective effect against Alzheimer's from the high dose flu vaccine. This builds on other evidence that shows the high-dose flu vaccine also reduces severity of infection in other areas. So is it conclusive? No. Would it be enough for me to think of this as an additional supportive point? Remember, the flu vaccine, the high-dose flu vaccine is available here in Ontario for adults.
And covered.
I would say yes, and covered. I would say this is another point suggesting about the effectiveness of this vaccine.
Alisa, would that help you convince people to get it?
I don't know, Libby. People are pretty fixed now in their beliefs around vaccination. I had a patient who, unfortunately, in March, had COVID and influenza at the same time because she had to go to eMERGE because she was so sick. And when they did the swab, it came back for positive. And so I've seen her now last week, which is at least a month, almost 6 weeks since she was sick, and she's still not feeling well. And I'm like, see, you need to get your shots next year. And she's like, no. So we had a big fight. So she still does not agree to get COVID. But I think maybe I've moved the needle a little bit in terms of her getting a flu shot next year. And I said to her, you're lucky. If you were 10, 15 years older, you could have died. But it's really, really hard to convince people. It gets back to our conversation about medical misinformation and just how with the algorithms, if you're looking up stuff that's related to that vaccines aren't helpful or bad, you will get more and more information about that. And that just confirms your belief that you think that, you know, it's the drug companies and everything. There's all these conspiracies and it's not there. So my opportunities are when people get sick and I try to push people, but the people who've always been vaccinated, they continue to be vaccinated. There was always this small percentage of people who never wanted to get vaccinated. And now that percentage after COVID has just increased. And it's really, really hard. This is like one of the things that's hard to get people. People get really worked up about vaccination. And I have no idea, because if you look through history of public health and what has worked from a health perspective, vaccination is one of those things that have helped increase the health of a population. So it's unfortunate.
It certainly is. And speaking of vaccinations, Malcolm, apparently our favorite dude, RFK Jr., is suppressing a study on how effective mRNA vaccines have been in preventing hospitalization and COVID.
Yeah, I mean, that's just stupid, honestly. Like, this is science, this is health, and you need data and you need information to make decisions. And if information which is accurate and well done is being suppressed because it doesn't align with a particular perspective of a health official, then that person is not doing their job. And I mean, I think it's a sad state of affairs if information that was done in a rigorous fashion is suppressed. I mean, that's getting us into a very different and quite a dark place, I think.
Well, yeah, I think we might be there already. Fahad, the Ontario government is again tweaking the rules for a medical residency. They had to back off a plan because of a legal challenge, and now I believe they're making it easier for people with a connection to Ontario to come back by having a provision about spending 6 months here. What do you make of that?
I love it. You know, I think they have struggled with finding the right way of trying to get more physicians who understand our system in. They initially, I believe, and you've heard, we talked about it on the panel, they went too far. We have a lot of foreign trained doctors who are incredible clinicians here in the system. One of them cares for my parents in Windsor and has provided exceptional care for more than 30 years. But it is, medicine is a cultural profession. Understanding the communities, the neighborhoods, the people that you're caring for is important. And so having a dedicated stream to have people who are from Ontario, who have done often very good training abroad, in the Irish system. I have colleagues who were trained at some of the top medical schools in the United States, but getting back into Canada has been challenging. This is providing a dedicated stream for them. So I love it. I think it's a good complement to other important approaches like the number of people we're training and all the other things we've talked about.
Malcolm? You're muted again. Let's take a call from Ron in Guelph. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Libby. So I'll make this quick. So I started getting the high-dose flu vaccine about 3 years ago. I don't know whether this is a coincidence, but I'm knocking on my head here, knock on wood. I can honestly say I haven't been sick. I used to get the flu, I used to get the colds, and I've gone well over 2 years now without being sick at all.
Okay, well, that is very good news. Sorry, go ahead.
The other thing that they can talk about is I'm more upset about the fact that at my age, 77 now, I have to pay a lot of money to get the shingles vaccine. And I don't know reason why, but why the health department in Ontario doesn't cover everybody over the age of 60 for the shingles vaccine. Maybe the doctors can comment on that.
Well, it's a money thing. Just taking a guess. Let's see. Do we have time for one more? Daryl in Toronto. Hi, Daryl. Quickly, please.
Hi, really quick, I wanted to ask the doctors. I've had 9 COVID shots so far. I didn't get one last spring, but I got one last October, and I just got a text from Shoppers that I'm due for the spring COVID shot. Is this something we should be doing every 6 months, or is it just Shoppers trying to double up on their income?
Okay, who wants to take to answer that quickly? Fahad?
Happy to start. Just to say that for a select group of people, so not knowing your medical history, we are suggesting a twice-a-year cycle of vaccination because we know the vaccine tends to wane for most people in protection after about 6 months, and the virus still can have surges in the summer. So if you're over 65, if you're immunosuppressed, not knowing your history, there's a checklist. Shoppers could go through that with you or your family physician. For everybody else, it's become a once-a-year vaccine.
Okay, I'm looking at the clock. We're out of time. Thank you so much, Malcolm Moore, Fahad Razak, and Alisa Naiman, and we will talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Have a good day.
Okay. Okay, so we're taking a break, and we just were able to confirm the next interview very recently. So we'll be talking to a former Prime Minister of Israel on the situation now. Today is Israel's Independence Day. It's the 78th anniversary, and we are soon going to be talking to former Prime Minister Ehud Barak.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Today marks the 78th anniversary of the founding of the State of Israel. It's Independence Day, Yom Ha'atzma'ut, and it comes after long weeks of fighting with Iran and Lebanon, and Israelis did not know how or even if they'd be able to celebrate today. What I am finding is from the Times of Israel, for instance, that thanks to the very fragile ceasefires that are underway and that appear to be broken, very recently, Israelis have been pouring into the streets and celebrating with beaches and barbecues and just checking in on the situation. I would now like to welcome former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, who also served as Defense Minister and Chief of the General Staff. Welcome. Shalom. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So what is your take? Israelis, of course, are famous for their resilience, celebrating in the midst of a very difficult time.
You know, these 2 days, the day of the Memorial Day for the fallen soldier, followed immediately by the Independence Day, put together the price of establishing a sovereignty on our old promised land, and the price of establishing this sovereignty. And we always put aside for these 2 days all disputes, everything that divides us, and celebrating together the very achievement after 2 millennia. And that's what happened even today under the shadow of the war that it's not yet clear to what extent it had already been ended.
Well, speaking of the war and the war on at least two fronts, a lot of the commentary and criticism is that the war with Iran is not going well. There were supposed to be more ceasefire talks in Pakistan. They have not happened. And the Islamic regime is not backing down. As a matter of fact, today they fired on three ships in the Straits of Hormuz, and it looks like Donald Trump may be the one backing down.
Look, from our point of view, this day of the 78th anniversary of Israel, we tend to look at the wider picture. We have a war now for 2.5 years. For us, it's the same war in a way. And during this war, there were unprecedented achievements of our military machinery, the IDF, the Air Force, the intelligence, and so on. Unprecedented achievement, both against the Hezbollah, against the Hamas, against the and clearly against the Iranians, but the truth is that beside these military achievements, the political goals of the war had not been achieved. None of them. Hamas, which is a tiny but resilient terror organization, is still alive and kicking in Gaza. Hezbollah is still alive and kicking in Lebanon. The Iranians survived the joint attack of Israel and the United States together. And there is a symmetry, deep asymmetry here that should be understood. We, the Israelis, Americans, we have to win in a way that every radio listener or TV watcher can identify as victory. For the Iranians, it's enough to survive. For the Hamas, it is enough to survive. To Hezbollah, it's enough to survive in order to announce victory. So in this asymmetry, there is a special need to contemplate every step in advance to make sure that you have a clear plan, you have a clear goals, you have the means to achieve them, you have the length of breath and tenacity to achieve it, and you have the political will to achieve it, and you have a clear vision, political, diplomatic vision, to the morning after the event. Because even in a war, somewhat like in economy, where there are known the law of diminishing return, you start, especially when you start it, it starts with a great achievement. And then there's a period where you can deepen the damage to the enemy. But then comes the question, how to end it? And it should be calculated for in advance, in a way. And that seems to be a missing block in the thinking about this war, especially the last stage against Iran.
It seems that that there's less backing from the Israeli public for the war, again, for the reasons you're citing, that there doesn't seem to be an end in sight, or it hasn't achieved all of its goals. And Israelis are, tired.
No, Israel is, our backyard, so to speak. Millions of Israelis at homes went through quite damaging attacks of missiles and so on, but they show impressive standing power in every place. In certain places, especially in the northern border, where there is also short-range attack from the Hezbollah, not just those from Iran. So the population, the civil society, is standing very, very well. The question mark is about the way that we are led by the political leadership, and there is dispute. Of course there are achievements, but it still remains very disturbing. If this this ceasefire will develop into certain kind of agreement, which won't be simple, because the previous agreement of 2015, signed by Obama and leaders of the world, including Russia and China, this was processed and discussed over about a year and a half or so. So to think that in some within 48 hours there will be a new agreement, detailed agreement, it's a fantasy. It won't happen. The most that can be achieved is something very general that describes the contours and continues the ceasefire in order to complete the details. So it will be something hanging in the air. And because when you look at the goals as stated by Trump, there is a gradual climbing down from the tree. There is no talks anymore about toppling down the regime. There are no very clear talks points about how exactly you are going to end the fact that Iran holds now some 440 kilograms of highly enriched uranium, very close, some 99% of the way toward weapon-grade material that could be used. And especially if this war will fail to take out these 440 kilograms of enriched uranium out of Iranian hands, you might find that the rational Iranian leader will think that the real lesson from the last two and a half years is that Iran should accelerate its effort to turn into nuclear power. And that's quite worrying, because if there is no clear-cut, observable controllable way to take out this enriched uranium from Iran, everything will remain open, whatever is discussed or signed. It's still an open. And the same applies to the missiles. Iranians argue that, they don't want to give their missile as long as Israel and America do not give up on their air forces, which is no starting point. In a way, Iran is much weaker than 8 months ago, and much weaker even than 3 weeks ago, or now, 6 weeks ago. And it's that's basically good. But they are far from being defeated. The regime, the IRGC, has a tight hold on the population through fear, sheer fear. And there is no sign that they are going to change. And they have very highly sophisticated negotiating practices, and they have their hold on the Hormuz. And it's a great riddle for me. How comes it that American, Israeli strategists did not take care of this issue of Hormuz in before the war, to think about it solely? The closing of the Hormuz Straits by the Iranian regime is part of any war gun that was carried out in any capital in the free world in the last 25 years at least. And the fact that somehow people believe that it would not be raised, would not be a real question, is somewhat kind of disturbing to think about.
Quick question to end. Can all of this, you think, dislodge Bibi Netanyahu through your prime minister?
No, we have a kind of election day in about half a year from now. Probably it will happen earlier. I'm one of the harshest critics of Netanyahu and his practices. I think that basically the years of his control, the recent year, somehow turned into realities that are becoming more and more severe, rather more and more simpler. For example, it was Netanyahu who convinced Trump to get out of the JCPOA, the previous the nuclear agreement that was reached in 2015. In 2018, Netanyahu convinced Trump to leave, Trump left it. At the time, Iran was 18 months from becoming a threshold nuclear power. When the new war opened some 9 months ago, they were only 18 days, probably minus 18 days. Probably they already have more enriched uranium than we ever know. So in a way, the Netanyahu complicated the situation by the mistakes of the past. And now trying to correct them, he tries his best, but he does it under kind of a deep kind of feeling in the Israeli public that in a way he's interested in dragging the war more than he is ultimately or absolutely needed. It started with his behavior about the hostages, and it continues his behavior regard to the agreement that the president of Lebanon proposed to have agreement with Israel to have to consider ceasefire, then dismantling the Hezbollah, and then even peace agreement, peace negotiation. And it didn't happen because Israel imposed a continuation of attacks inside Beirut, where the whole public is seeing. You can see it from the president's palace and so on. So we have our burden, and I can never forget the fact that this government is running during the war, where all of us supposed to be united in order to defeat our enemies. They continue what they call the judicial reform, and we call judicial coup d'etat. And, you know, there is a total loss of the three pillars of a successful democracy, which is truth, trust, and integrity. The public in Israel, most of the public, do not trust the existence of those elements in the policies of our present government. Truth, trust, and integrity. And that creates a shadow over this celebration, but this is not the right day to discuss it in details.
Okay. Thank you so much. Very insightful conversation. And again, happy Yom HaAtzmaut. Bye-bye.
Thank you, and best to all your listeners.
Thank you. All right, people, we are taking a break. And when we come back, you know, if you've been listening, you've been hearing me ruminating about the creepiest thing that happened to me online in the last few days. So what did I do? Of course, I'm turning to Carmi Levy for him to try to explain it to me when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, our listeners have heard me complaining about the creepiest thing that happened to me in the last few days, and it involved a very mundane task that I got to on the weekend. I was washing my makeup sponges, and I had the phone near me, and I did not ask anything about this task. I did not tell the phone anything about this task. But afterwards, my feed was full of these so-called hacks for washing makeup sponges. And they featured the exact kind that I happened to be using and washing. And I thought, my goodness, how did this happen? So first, people, I want to hear from you if you've had creepy experiences. It is 866-744-7740. That's our text line, our long distance phone line, 416-360-0740. And now I turn to tech expert Carmi Levy. Hi, Carmi.
Hi, Libby. So good to see you. You're not the only one who's feeling creeped out. This happens, I think, increasingly to all of us. It's happened to me. I hear it from friends and family members and colleagues as well. This is rampant. It's kind of life in the information age, but doesn't make it any easier to accept. But do have some confidence that you are not alone in this.
Okay. Well, how does it happen?
Well, I mean, it all comes down to, this is sort of the way the information economy works. Every time we install an app, every time we sign into a service, we are giving permission to that app, to that service, to access certain pieces of data. And we're not really paying attention. When you install an app, usually as part of that process, there's a little pop-up message, do you accept the terms of service or the terms of use? And most of us are in such a rush to get through that process that we click accept. I authorize, and then we click the button and we move on and we forget that we ever did that. But if we stopped to read those terms of use or terms of service, and they are available in the settings of the app, we would realize that we are granting that app access to certain parts of our device. So it can access the camera, the microphone, the GPS, our contacts, our schedule, all sorts of things, maybe even data from other apps and other services. And so all that information gets collected collected in the background. We don't see it happening, but as every time we turn our phone on, it's happening very quietly. And then that information is used by the app developers, by the platforms that we buy the devices from, the operating systems, everyone involved in the process. They use that to figure out, okay, what makes Libby tick? What is she interested in? What ad should I serve up that she is most likely to respond to? So it's really all about very targeted advertising using the data that we decided to give permission to be shared, but we just weren't paying attention when we said okay.
Well, I was wondering, I thought, was my camera on by mistake? And again, these were hacks. I have to say they were quite stupid, but I mean, does the camera not have to be on for it to figure out what I'm doing, you know, a few feet away?
Yeah, and that's the thing is, you know, we're giving access to pieces of hardware, microphone, camera, GPS, etc. But we don't really see, you know, when that access is occurring. In other words, I don't know when that app, and I've got probably a few dozen apps on my phone right now, and all of them, or most of them, probably have, I've granted that permission. But I don't see in real time when they're doing so. But I've got to assume, because I said yes, it's probably happening quietly. And so it could very well be your phone was sitting on the vanity as you were doing your makeup or taking your makeup off. And it could very well be that the device was now aware of it. Maybe it did take a snapshot. Maybe the camera was activated. Or maybe you bought that product recently and it's correlating it to other information, for example, financial information on your invoice that you gave to your payment processor. So all sorts of different information is being collected on us in the background. It's being put together to create a very comprehensive picture of what you're interested in and what you may very well be doing at this given moment. And it may not even have anything to do with anything that we're doing. It could be we simply happen to be in a certain place. You ever notice sometimes in your social media feed, you'll notice that posts from somebody who you never interact with all of a sudden start showing up in your inbox. But look at that. They were in the same park that we were just last week. So in many cases, it's location that becomes the trigger and it puts two and two together. And next thing you know, you're getting ads or you're seeing things in social media that are very relevant to you. It's kind of how the process works. And because we've agreed to share so much information, sometimes it comes back to us in, frankly, disturbing or creepy ways.
Okay, let's hear from Melinda in Western New York. Hi, Melinda.
Hi, Libby. How are you?
I'm good. You must be a first-time caller, yes?
Well, I called in like years ago when a gentleman used to do the show.
Okay, I'm giving you the bell. Uh-oh.
Awesome.
Okay, welcome, Melinda. Tell us about your creepy experience.
Well, I do private home care for the elderly, and one of my clients has an Alexa. And this is back before I had a cell phone. I've just recently acquired a cell phone. I never really wanted one, but I ended up having to get one for work purposes. So anyway, her and I would discuss, you know, health-related things in her home. And then I would get home and go on my own computer at home and get ads for what we discussed. And I always thought that was very, very bizarre.
Well, we're hearing it's not bizarre, but it's definitely creepy. Thank you for telling us about that. So, Carmi, you know, you have to agree to get the app you want. So what can we do to get around this, or can we?
Yeah, we can. We can agree less. And, you know, in Melinda's case, right, so it could very well be that she has the Alexa app installed on her phone. And we know that these intelligent assistants, so it could be Google Assistant or Google Gemini, could be Apple Siri, in this case, Amazon Alexa. It's always listening for the command word. And so even if you don't give it the command word, the microphone is on. And so if you're talking about it with someone and your phone is there, it knows that you had that conversation and it will then serve that up as part of your Amazon Alexa account later. later on. So what we do is we share less. We don't install every app on our device. So there are fewer apps that are listening in. If we're not using an app, we should get rid of it, because the app, even if we haven't used it in a year, it's still sitting three screens deep on our phone and it's still collecting that information in the background. So do a periodic cleanup of your phone just to make sure that, yeah, if I'm not using that app anymore, or if I'm not using that service, let me close down that account and get rid of it. That way it stops the data leakage. And at the same time, also look at the settings of the apps that you are using. You don't always have to grant every single permission in order to use the app successfully. You can go into the settings and say, if there's no reason for it to access the camera, you can turn that off. Same thing with the microphone or GPS or other parts of the device. You can reduce the amount of data that any given app shares. And that's usually found in the settings. But most of us don't want to take the time, but we'd be pleasantly surprised if we did dig in and realize, wow, you know, I can reduce my data footprint a little bit if I take a few minutes just to do a bit of a cleanup.
Okay. Before we go, our last conversation was about the surveillance prices, pricing. So tell me again how we can browse privately or try to minimize that.
Yeah. So, I mean, and in fact, they're essentially two sides of the same coin. So if we want to minimize our exposure to surveillance or dynamic pricing, we can use private browsing or what's called incognito browsing. So when you open up a browser session, you can open it up in private or incognito mode. That way you don't sign into it. It doesn't collect more information about you. It limits the amount of data that's shared about you when you connect to a website or a web service. So it's not as convenient, because sometimes you'll have to enter your username and password on your own. It doesn't remember it from one session to another. It takes a little bit more effort, but it means a lot less data is being lifted off of your device and onto the services that you're connecting to. It reduces the amount of information that's shared, or the potential for these companies that we're dealing with digitally to jack prices up on us because they have more information on our background.
Okay, so yeah, and I will not keep my phone near me if there's no reason to. I think that is the overarching lesson of this, right?
Right on. These things are always spying on us. And even if we're not actively using our devices, like if I go take the dog for a walk and I put my phone in my pocket and I don't touch it for the hour that we're out there, my phone still knows where I am. And it still kind of remembers when the wireless networks that it passes or other people that we might interact with. So it's still collecting information. If I really wanted to sort of stay below the digital radar, I would either turn the phone off and keep it on me for emergencies, or I just wouldn't leave it near me at all. So, be very careful what you say around your phone. It's always watching and listening.
Okay. I think I'll turn it off more often. Carmi, thank you so much for that.
Really appreciate it, Libby. Thanks.
Okay. Okay. That's all the time we have, people. If I could not take your call about this, Free for All Friday is coming up and we can get to this again. Meantime, that's all the time we have for Fight Back for today. Follow us on YouTube. Follow us on Instagram. I will be back here tomorrow, and we'll talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.